and wintry showers at times across Antrim and Down. 5 is our forecast high for Belfast. For Scotland, a light wind as well, certainly lighter than the wind to the south of the UK, and that should make the sunshine in the west feel quite pleasant. A high of 5 to come in Glasgow. A little bit cooler in the east though, more cloud and a few wintry flurries around, just 4 for Aberdeen. Back to Zoe.
Thanks, Susan. Now on BBC Radio 4, our book of the week, Comandante, Rory Carroll's biography of the late Hugo Chavez. In 2002, the Chavez presidency had its most turbulent year. The reader is Jack Claff.
The screen shook as if the cameraman was nervous or maybe just excited. It zoomed on a pair of feet, then panned low and wide across Baralt Avenue. A million feet, maybe more, marching on the palace. By some counts, the biggest march in Venezuela's history. They had tramped the city from east to west, stamping and singing, "He's going to fall, he's going to fall." It was April the 11th, 2002. The images from outside Miraflores that mesmerized the country were replaced by a government logo and the sound of trumpets. This is a special announcement from the Ministry of Communication and Information. The president appeared, looking solemn. He was wearing a suit and sat at a desk framed by a Venezuelan flag and a portrait of Simon Bolivar. "Good afternoon, my dear fellow countrymen and countrywomen of Venezuela. Here we are, as ever, facing our responsibilities." The president was in Salon Ayacucho, named after the battlefield that sealed South America's independence. It was beneath the palace, beside a chapel and a dungeon reinforced to withstand bullets and bombs. He continued,
"I've taken this decision to call this special radio and television broadcast to send a message to all Venezuelans, especially that minority who appear to not want to hear, who appear to not want to see, who appear to not want to accept reality."
All channels had been ordered to carry the broadcast. The president wished to show he was in command, but he was not. While he was talking and monopolizing the nation's screens, mayhem erupted outside the palace walls. Molotov cocktails shattered and flamed. Bullets hissed. The marchers looked around in panic. Gunfire seemed to be coming from all directions. People collapsed onto the asphalt and lay motionless, blood pooling around them. A massacre was unfolding. The crisis had started a week earlier, when the president made a very different broadcast on his television show. Ebullient and combative, he had fired and humiliated oil company executives, reading out names one by one. The broadcast delighted supporters and enraged opponents. Within days, the opposition called a general strike, then this march. Ostensibly, it was to demand the executives' reinstatement, but really, it was to channel the boiling resentments of those, half the country according to polls, who hated Chavez. The media lords, the tycoons, executives, generals and bishops pulled strings behind the scenes. If they were going to attempt a coup, this was the moment. A human river filled streets and avenues, chanting, drumming, banging pots, hundreds of thousands of people, some said more than a million. At the front, leading them all, holding a giant Venezuelan flag, 3 men, Pedro Carmona, Carlos Ortega and Guaycaipuro Lameda. Carmona, patrician and grandfatherly, headed the business federation. Ortega, a chunky, gravel-voiced firebrand, headed the country's biggest union. Lameda, just 2 months out of government, symbolized the fired oil workers and those who had believed in, then broken with, Chavez. The march was supposed to end at the oil company's headquarters, but the speeches demanding the president back down didn't satisfy the turbulent sea of banners and faces. It had heard this before and now, intoxicated by its size and energy, demanded more, demanded that Chavez go. Marching on Miraflores was forbidden, but the crowd was heedless and rushed on, rushed to sweep Chavez away. With Miraflores just a few blocks away, National Guard troops and pro-Chavez grassroots groups, called Bolivarian Circles, occupied side streets. They were vastly outnumbered, but armed and resolved to protect the president. Lameda, his suit rumpled and tie askew because he had been carried on shoulders to stay ahead of the crowd, had planned with other leaders to demand to meet Chavez. But the path to Miraflores was blocked. Lameda hopped on the back of a motorbike and roared toward Venevision, the country's largest privately owned television network, to explain, he said later, what was happening. While Lameda and other interviewees, all anti-Chavez, explained why the president should resign, the standoff around Baralt Avenue exploded into violence. The president cut in with his broadcast, obliging Venevision and all other channels to show his soothing message. As long as he spoke, no channel, in theory, could show the violence unfolding outside. Chavez's tone was calm. He asked those who had marched on the palace to reflect and repent. "The situation is under control," he said. It was not under control. The nation had seen the drama on the streets while he talked, because four private stations broke the chain by splitting the screen. On one side, the president, on the other, live images of smoke, bodies, blood. After the broadcast, the president left Salon Ayacucho using palace tunnels for fear of snipers, and in his office swapped his suit for combat fatigues. He strapped a pistol to his leg and grabbed a rifle. But the most powerful weapon in this battle for power was not the gun, but television. That evening, while the president hunkered in the palace, private television channels showed more footage, recorded earlier, of pro-Chavez supporters shooting into Baralt Avenue. Then it showed wounded and dead. There were 19 dead and hundreds wounded. Some of the dead were Chavez supporters, and it remained unclear who had done the killing. By now it was dark, and Lameda was touring one studio after another, denouncing the president and urging his friends and comrades in the military high command to intervene. Other opposition leaders echoed the call. Within hours, the top brass issued an ultimatum saying it would bomb Miraflores unless the president resigned. Inside his office, Chavez felt trapped and desperate. Tear gas and bullets had dispersed the march, but he was being blamed for the massacre. Many generals had abandoned him. Ministers and officials were in hiding, fearing retribution. Others roamed Miraflores, frightened and uncertain. Chavez appeared so desolate, aides eyed his pistol, which he had placed on his desk, and feared suicide. At this moment, a fateful phone call. Fidel Castro.
Chavez, do not sacrifice yourself. Do not be a martyr like Allende. You must survive.
As midnight approached, he took the advice. Word spread that he agreed to resign on condition he and his family would be exiled in Cuba. He walked through corridors of weeping aides and was driven to Fuerte Tiuna, where he handed himself over to the generals, a prisoner. The next day, April the 12th, a helicopter took Chavez to Turiamo, a Caribbean naval base, then to an island, La Orchilla. Later that day, the generals invited Carmona, the Business Federation leader, to form a provisional government at Miraflores. Small, bald, mild, a former diplomat, he was called a conciliator, level-headed, a safe pair of hands. How then to explain what happened next? His whole life Carmona had served power. Now he felt he was man of the hour, savior of the republic. He took the presidential chair, and he nodded to the newly appointed Solicitor General, who started reading out decrees. The National Assembly was to be dissolved. The audience cheered. All state governors were to be replaced. Louder cheers. The following were to be abolished. The Supreme Court, the Office of the People's Defender, the National Electoral Council. As the list went on, the audience exploded in whoops. When the Constitution was revoked, they hugged and wept with joy. There was to be a presidential election the following year. It was the liquidation of Chavez and everything he had created, with no pretense of inclusion or promise of immediate elections. The previous day's protest march had become a coup d'etat. In fact, Carmona was not really in charge of government. The generals picked him to give a civilian veneer to their overthrow of Chavez. But Carmona acted as if power truly were his. He offered posts to friends, but nothing to the head of the army, nothing to the trade unions, nothing to anyone from the previous government, nothing to the millions who supported Chavez. The new president was so busy giving orders, he was oblivious to the draft that rustled his papers, the cold gazes of guards, the icy tone of switchboard operators, the dropping temperature. Within hours, a revolt began in the military city of Maracay, where the commander of the 42nd Paratrooper Brigade was Raúl Baduel, the clandestine conspirator in Chavez's failed coup in 1992. Baduel rallied not just his brigade, but the entire 4th Division against Carmona. Word spread, and events moved quickly. Other divisions denounced Carmona and demanded Chavez's restitution. By the morning of April the 13th, the hill dwellers around Caracas had recovered from their shock and began to stream down into the valley, demanding the president's return. Television stations mentioned nothing of the army mutiny, nor the Chavez supporters filling the streets. The coup was the opposition's original sin, a transgression against democratic, legal, and moral norms that branded it for years to come. Its leaders were exposed as hypocrites who preached democracy only to usurp it, and to be so inept they made Chavez stronger, a victim and a hero. Lameda, the man whom Chavez had brought into government and trusted, had been in the thick of it. That such a stickler for old-fashioned rules and principles was implicated showed how polarization spun the country's moral compass, subsuming right and wrong into the greater issue, for or against Chavez. A decade later, Lameda cleared his throat and defended himself the best he could. No, he had not been part of any pre-April the 11th conspiracy. No, the opposition had not planted snipers to provoke bloodshed and justify Chavez's removal. No, he had made no deal with Carmona to be named head of PDVSA. Nevertheless, Lameda accepted Carmona's job offer, and on the morning of April the 11th went to Miraflores to be formally reinstated as head of the oil company.
"I was putting together the list of names for the new board, getting ready for our swearing in, and then..."
Lameda paused, shook his head, still struck by the memory.
"A waiter came in and told us a crowd of Chavez supporters, Chavistas, was approaching Miraflores and that we should go."
The crowd had surrounded the palace, but Lameda escaped through an emergency exit and made his way to the military base. He realized the armed forces had turned against the regime, but found Carmona and generals squabbling over ministerial appointments as if they were still in control. Then the penny dropped. Carmona was arrested. Lameda was allowed to scuttle home. At the same time, commandos dispatched by Baduel rescued Chavez from La Ochila and flew him back to Caracas. Later that night, on television, Lameda watched the denouement. Spotlights in Miraflores picked out a helicopter that slowly descended amid a rapturous, jubilant throng. Chavez, resurrected, walked among them, hugging and smiling, bathed in the flash of 100 cameras. The truth about April the 11th remained shrouded. Each side accused the other of massacring innocents and manipulating video footage. Witnesses contradicted each other, changed their stories, fled the country. A truth inquiry was suspended, and criminal investigations stalled. Carmona, baptized Pedro the Brief by Chavez, bribed his way to freedom and exile.
Comandante by Rory Carroll was abridged by Pete Nichols and read by Jack Claff. The producer was Karen Rose, and it's a Sweet Talk production for BBC Radio 4. The shipping forecast is here in just a moment. First, sailing by. And now the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Wednesday, the 27th of March, 2013. The general synopsis at 1800. High, southern Norway, 1027, expected Latvia, 1025, by 1800 Wednesday. Low, southwest Fitzroy, 996, expected southeast Fitzroy, 1000, by same time. New low, moving rather quickly eastwards, expected south Trafalgar, 1004, by that time. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. Viking, variable 3 or 4, snow showers, good, occasionally poor. North Utsira, variable 3 or less, fair, good. South Utsira, northerly, becoming variable 3 or 4, fair, good. North 40s,